Hello and welcome to Millions of Screens. I'm creator producer Leo Garcia, joined via Zoom by TV Awards editor Libby Hill and TV deputy editor Ben Travers. Today we're talking Godzilla versus Kong. That's right. It premiered yesterday on HBO Max and will be in theaters most anywhere that have open theaters. But yeah, we're going to be talking about that amongst other things. I think we'll have a little discussion about who's Team Kong and who's Team Godzilla.
We're probably going to spoil some stuff, so I would gird your ears. We'll warn you when it's time, but at one point we will discuss the winner and allow the respective parties to
really, I think the winner's already written all over your face.
I will say I don't know if it's just the digital camera, but it does look like Libby's wearing green.
Oh, I am.
Oh, interesting.
And pants.
Wow.
Gotta support the home team.
This is millions and millions of little screens.
Can't you shut up? I'm busy. Boy, what a great show.
Skipping ahead to the clicker, our recap of the biggest news items from this past week. This upcoming Sunday, Easter Sunday, the SAG Awards will be airing on TNT, TBS? Yes. Maybe all of the above. TNT and TBS. Wow.
But it's only an hour long, so really it's not that big of an interruption for them.
A hostless virtual ceremony. Essentially just a list of winners, an hour long list of winners, which is how maybe all award shows should be from now on.
No. Let's not go crazy. I mean, if it's a list of winners and they show clips, then we can talk about it. But if it's just a list of winners and somebody saying thank you, then I can't get on board with that.
Clips and winners. We want clips and winners. That's what award show should be moving forward. I wanted to touch base with you guys in advance of this. Just what are you guys thinking? Is it going to be more of the same? The Crown, Ted Lasso, Queen's Gambit?
I mean, I have no reason to think it won't be. You know, the actors aren't exactly iconoclastic. They'll choose... They'll go out of the box sometimes. I know Ben was very excited last year with Jennifer Aniston's SAG win. She was not successful anywhere else, but take home the SAG award. But then, like, if you're looking at their TV winners from last year, it was, you know, the leads of Fosse Verdon, Sam Rockwell, and Michelle Williams, and Peter Dinklage for Game of Thrones, and Tony Shalhoub and Phoebe Waller-Bridge for Maisel and Fleabag, respectively. And then the ensembles were The Crown and Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Like, that is who, at that juncture, we assumed kind of the winners would largely reflect when the Emmys came around. And partially because most of those people had already been awarded at the previous Emmys, but... also because they were in play coming up, which to me says, look for Schitt's Creek to have its final stand here. There'll be a lot of Schitt's Creek winners. Where Schitt's Creek doesn't win, look for Ted Lasso, which is what we've seen at all of the awards things to date. I think you could definitely look for some Bridgerton upsets here, though... SAG's awarding The Crown ensemble last year for an ostensibly bad season of The Crown, as far as those things go. It's kind of an indicator that they don't care about quality as much. But yeah, like Ben, what do you think when you look at these?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, it seems like an inevitable Crown sweep. In the drama categories, again, there's only three drama categories, three comedy categories, and two limited series categories, which, by the way, Libby, when are we going to get a limited series ensemble? Like, there's just so many limited series at this point. They're right up there with the rest of them. I don't know what they're waiting on.
I know. Like, I don't either. It's so often, especially as I'm looking ahead to the Emmys, you know, increasingly the two big, most competitive categories are drama and limited series. Oftentimes with limited series outstripping the drama season race. So it's unfortunate that the SAGs have not kind of moved to incorporate that. But
yeah, I mean, especially this year when there's just so many limited series in competition, like, and there will be even more in competition for the Emmys.
But I would say that, like, of all of the awards that Mrs. America should have won, I think the SAG on an imaginary SAG ensemble cast was made for them, but not made for them because it doesn't exist. But yeah,
getting back on point. I do think there will probably be a crown sweep. My one hope is that Regé-Jean topples Josh O'Connor for actor. Really, I hope that Bob Odenkirk wins that, but I think that seems pretty out of reach at this point, sadly. But yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of repeats. I think that the limited series race, as Leo alluded to, I think before we started recording, between Michaela Cole and Anya Taylor-Joy, both nominated for the first time in an expected race at the Emmys. Will be interesting to see who triumphs there. But yeah, I think I'm most interested at this point in the structure of the show, it being pre-taped and an hour long. I just am really curious what it even feels like. Are we even going to remember this? Is there going to be an impact from the SAGs? An hour seems really great on the one hand, and also just kind of empty on the other. So how they fill it with life is kind of my top of mind concern at this point.
I am very excited to see what will be longer, the SAG ceremony or how long it takes you to write about the SAG ceremony.
Ooh,
it'll put a clock on it.
It'll be the writing. I don't think I could do it in under an hour.
Well, skipping ahead to the next item on our clicker, Obi-Wan Kenobi, new series from Star Wars and Disney Plus. They dropped this insane sort of like cast sheet a couple days ago, and I just wanted to get real quick head thoughts. What's the craziest face/name on this cast sheet?
Like, I kind of can't believe, like, we're talking about, like, I feel like Benny Safdie is a home run there, as far as the being in a cast for a Star Wars series on Disney Plus. Yeah, I don't even know what else to say about that. Like, I thought maybe it was a prank. Like, when I saw this cast, because it has legitimately, like, how many people on it?
I think it's 12
people. 12 people on it. It's bananas.
I honestly think the most exciting thing about Disney casting these days, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, it's like we're not learning who's going to be in the show and getting excited to see Benny Safdie in a Star Wars series. We're learning, oh, Benny Safdie is part of the Star Wars universe now, which means Disney is aware of him, which means he's going to have a little money to play with and make some really fun shit after this. Like, he's going to have a little more freedom to do what he wants, which is really, really exciting. And I would say that also holds true for someone like Rupert Friend, who I've always liked from Homeland. He was also part of the Obi-Wan cast. And Joel Edgerton, an actor and filmmaker who I greatly admire. And if this helps boost awareness of Joel Edgerton's filmography, perhaps a few more people watch Warrior, and perhaps we get Warrior 2. Oh man, Obi-Wan will be the MVP TV series of all time. That's a big, big leap, but that's really all that I've got in terms of excitement. I mean, it's quite a cast. Sung Kang is on there. I mean, what are we talking about?
Joel Edgerton reprising his role as Uncle Owen from the prequels. I remember reading a story about, like, the fact that when he got cast in, he, like, went around, got meetings, and, like, got cast in this thing, and essentially lied about his experience before getting cast.
Joel is a savvy, savvy man.
I found that what it was, he didn't bluff his way or lie his way into Star Wars. He said that essentially after he was cast in Star Wars and filmed his part, there's such a long post on those movies. There were essentially 18 months between when he filmed it and when it was released. He used that 18-month window to take, like, every meeting in the world. And he would just say, like, I'm in the upcoming Star Wars movie. Like, I have a part. I can't tell you, obviously, under wraps. But, like, he used that line to get into a bunch of offices to try to get other movies he wanted to get made in the pipeline. And it's like, way to go.
A-plus Hollywood gamesmanship. I love it.
Yeah, he said, I'm in Star Wars. I'm not telling you that I'm only in it for 5 minutes and I don't have a lightsaber. Well, last week we talked a little bit about the state of HBO Max as it sits. I wanted to update a little bit just because I came across this stat online, which is the week of Justice League's release, HBO Max saw an 8% uptick in use in its app and a 64% uptick in downloads. This is according to Apptopia, which I guess measures app opens and usage. It's still, in terms of total app sessions, a drop in the bucket compared to what Netflix gets on average. But it was sort of telling to say that maybe this strategy is panning out, and maybe it'll pan out even more with the release of Godzilla vs. Kong, which we've teased a little bit at the beginning of this episode. Ben, before we get into any spoilerific discussion, I know you want to sort of talk about, you know, what this means. We've been talking about WandaVision and Falcon and Winter Soldier for, you know, several months at this point. But what Godzilla versus Kong entering the TV space, as it were, means overall to the various cinematic universes.
Right, right. I think cinematic universes are really the key word. And I don't want to lie to the listeners. I don't think I could. I don't think I'd be able to get away with it. We are talking about Godzilla versus Kong because all three of us are extremely, extremely excited about Godzilla versus Kong. That is the real reason we're talking about Godzilla versus Kong. But this is a TV podcast. We try to talk about TV. If you are disappointed that we're not talking about Falcon and Winter Soldier this week, technically we kind of are going to get into that in a little bit. But this is the latest entry in what has been referred to. I don't know if it's officially referred to as the MonsterVerse. Do we know if like that's part of?
Said that. I don't know if that's what it's called.
No, but like people call it that. I just don't know if like Legendary Pictures and Warner Brothers Films releases that in their or uses that in their press releases. But this is the cinematic universe. It started with the 2014 yes. film Godzilla. Oh, they do?
It is the MonsterVerse.
The MonsterVerse.
Great. I do think that's kind of confusing, if only because for anyone who remembers when
the old movie monsters,
right? The Frankenstein mummy kind of thing, right? That was supposed to start a new universe of itself, the dark universe. It's like, well, that could have been called the MonsterVerse 2, so this is a little bit whatever. But anyway,
the MonsterVerse 2?
No, as well.
No. The MonsterVerse, comma, 2.
Oh, okay.
The MonsterVerse.
Like,
N-O,
Monsters,
period.
Inc.
Two. Okay.
Oh, boy. But no, I think that talking about these in terms of cinematic universes and how often cinematic universes are compared to kind of serialized TV and just kind of noting, you know, what they're borrowing from serialized storytelling that we see so often on television to make these cinematic universes work, as well as kind of the general appeal of the cinematic universe to people who are viewing everything on the same platforms these days, who are watching TV on the same service that they watch movies, especially right now where HBO Max is releasing these movies, you know, directly into homes, that are, as well as theaters, but directly into homes. So yeah, I thought it would be good to kind of talk about that a little bit this week, as well as, again, getting into the nuts and bolts of Godzilla versus Kong and what went wrong with what could have been the best movie of the year, if not for some clearly misguided
calculations. You're literally complaining about Black Panther right now.
Do we want it?
No, I think so.
Do we want it? Do we want to talk about the poll we had first before we talk about
I think that's another great
way good place to start.
So yeah, you know, Ben sort of talking about how this is sort of the cinematic universe is bleeding over into television. We did post a poll on IndieWire asking how people were planning to watch Godzilla versus Kong. 43% essentially said HBO Max would be where they were watching it. 16.9% said in theaters. 8.8 said on IMAX, and then 32%, a very large percentage of people, not the majority, but a large percentage, said none of the above, not interested in watching Godzilla versus Kong. Though I would want to add that I think some of that, at least a percentage of that, is fans of Zack Snyder's Justice League coming out in support of restoring the Snyderverse, and wanting Warner Brothers to give Zack Snyder carte blanche to finish his 5-movie Justice League arc. So we don't get an accurate reading of how many people actually did not want to watch Godzilla vs. Kong. This is happening concurrent with a movement on IMDb.com to give Godzilla vs. Kong 1-star ratings, which have nothing to do with the movie itself, solely to tell Warner Brothers that they want Zack Snyder to be able to complete his 5-film Snyderverse. A lot of the comments actually will say things like, the movie is good, this is for Warner Brothers, restore the Snyderverse, or movie 5 out of 5, Warner Brothers 0 out of 5, things along those lines. But yeah, still, HBO Max won out. More people want to watch on HBO Max than Snyder Bros not wanting anyone to watch Godzilla vs. Kong.
And more people wanted to watch it on HBO Max than the combined total of in theaters and IMAX, which, you know, obviously IMAX is also a theater. But it is strange to see these two obviously distinct cinematic universes, I guess if we're calling the Snyderverse that, warring with each other for no real reason whatsoever, other than kind of confusion, I guess, over you know, how movies are released and like how long they take to make them and where priorities are placed. Like, I
Snyder Bros have no reason to think that this won't work. Is the sad thing about the release of the Snyder Cut is like there's no reason for them, like they don't understand correlation and causation, and they don't care, and they're just gonna keep doing what they do and ruining good polls this podcast puts out.
I did want to read one good comment from someone rather close to the pod. We had plenty of comments on Twitter underneath the poll, which you can read for yourself if you want. I didn't receive any emails this week, which was somewhat surprising. But
is your mom mad at you?
I think she's still waiting to see Kong versus Godzilla before chiming in. She just has to be as informed as possible before delivering her take. But friend of the podcast, I think I'm using this correctly, Steve Recommendation Machine Green chimed in saying, I voted in this poll, even though there's no option for the true correct answer, which would be rewatching Godzilla 2014 instead. And I honestly think that's a pretty good lead in to discussing this cinematic universe, because again, this started, I know, like Kong and Godzilla have a long legacy in theaters, outside of theaters, just unto themselves that we're not going to dig into. We're going to focus on this newly established cinematic universe, which started in 2014 with Gareth Edwards. Okay, great. 2014 Godzilla. And I do think there's like a very interesting through line from where that movie started. Like, that movie had such like a specific vision to what it wanted to be. It was very distinct from the rest of the franchise and what the franchise has clearly grown into. It wasn't a huge hit. It did well enough. It made about $560 million worldwide, $200 million in the States. But against a $200 million budget, that's not exactly where they want it to be. And yet it still birthed this universe. It's still like they kept growing from there to see where they could take it. And it just quickly turned away from that. Like the first movie is like very much making a statement about, I think Libby could probably speak to this better as a Godzilla fan, but making a statement about the purpose of Godzilla and what Godzilla represents, especially in a world where humanity is kind of tearing itself apart and you know, eating itself from the inside. But by the end of it, by Kong versus Godzilla, it's just action figures smashing together. It's just the battle royale. I don't think there's really any commentary within the last Godzilla film, but it just slowly got bled out of the series. I'd argue that the second film, Kong Skull Island, also had plenty of commentary about kind of using Kong as a Vietnam surrogate, where he was just kind of the innocent bystander who was on the island, and they started dropping bombs and he's only reacting, and then they turn him into an enemy because they needed an enemy at that time. And it was like, okay, I guess this kind of works. And then they just slowly turn it into, well, Kong is just a nice gorilla, and he needs to find his family, and that's all you need to worry about. So
they turn Kong into a protagonist. They turn Godzilla into an anti-hero, and it's wild because people just really want them to see them go full rampage.
All right, so now I'll just, this is the official we're going to talk spoilers, Godzilla v Kong, because we've been traipsing around the spoiler patch for a little bit. Ben may have said a spoiler or two in his last sentence.
I'm so sorry. I'm terrible at this.
about Kong looking focused for his family.
Well, aren't we all? But no, I mean, I'm just curious from your standpoint. Actually, let's start with Leo, because I know you had a kind of a negative reaction to all of these movies. what do you think actually sustained interest, and how do you think of the development, like, from the first movie through this fourth and, like, at least temporarily final chapter, yeah, like a some sort of finale-esque, season finale-esque bookend?
Yeah, let me just say this. I don't know if I would ever not watch one of these movies on streaming. Like, I don't know if I would ever pay money to... Maybe there is something to the spectacle of watching Fire Breath. Yeah, I think all these movies have issues. I don't think any of these movies are quote-unquote good. After finishing Godzilla vs. Kong, my first thought was, that was stupid fun. It's stupid fun. There's nothing there. There is no social commentary. There is no human character to glom onto to be like, this is my surrogate. It is literally a smash-em-up. With the most, and I think this is my main problem with all of the movies, is the scientific gobbledygook that all of them sort of espouse. Truly insane.
Wow, I didn't know you didn't believe in a hollow earth, but okay.
Yeah, look, I'm not a big believer in the hollow earth.
Get on board.
Which is crazy coming from me, I know, Ben, as I think the preeminent fan of the MCU on the podcast. Where it's like, there's magic and aliens, but like some of the rules of our world still apply. Whereas like this is like in that fantasy world, the Earth still has a solid core and a molten lava core, the outer core that surrounds it. They're not traveling to the
like
center
the
of the Earth.
And the...
I had a lot of questions when they got to the hollow Earth. You know, just in general. But the main one was just, shouldn't it be hotter? Like, shouldn't it be
hotter? Smaller? It should also be very small and, like, claustrophobic.
How was their... What was their light source?
It's just the Hollow Earth, Libby. You learned to forget it. If they were traveling to a different planet, I'd believe
it
more.
It's Hollow Earth. It's
Forget it, Libby.
It's
Hollow Earth.
I guess the ground is reflecting itself because there's like ground above and ground below, and the cracks in it from like wherever the molten earth actually exists, where the core is, glows up and then reflects back and then goes down and reflects. I don't know.
Also,
there's no
gravity split.
Yeah, gravity split where you have the floating rocks. This is like someone took all of Chris Nolan's movies, shook them up, and we're like, let's have a world that's like, it's part Interstellar, it's part Inception, but also it'll keep the King Kong and Godzilla of it all.
Still more fun than half of Nolan's oeuvre.
I mean, I could go for hours on my kvetches on this movie. Like it takes Godzilla no time to drill a hole to the center of the Earth. Like it takes him a minute and a half to get from outer core to the hollow Earth. That is very fast.
But also then Kong crawls through that hole.
I know,
after originally he had to get like sucked down through a gravitational thing that then like twisted things around and like shot like, and he just was like, no, I'm just going to take the stairs this time.
Which I don't
know. I think but it was still a hole again.
It was a hole.
Like, it was still a hole, but.
But he wasn't climbing out. He was falling down again.
My big thing
is. Not when he came to fight Godzilla. When he came to fight Godzilla, he like crawls out of the hole and is like,
he
here I am.
Out of the hole, but he falls into it from Hollow Earth. Because he's, I remember he's using his little axe, so he doesn't go too fast.
Oh, that's right.
I would say blurs.
This is like when you dig a hole and you come out in China. This time you dig a hole.
That's
and
exactly
come out in
Japan. What it was.
I would say what my another part I didn't enjoy there was like as a team Kong guy. How are you gonna go right up the same hole where he just blew the hole with his fire breath? Not smart.
Yeah, he could catch you in the middle there, and you're in trouble.
I'm going to a different hole, and then coming back around the planet, so he can't get me with laser breath on a second shot. That's crazy.
You know what, though, Leo? He knew that there was no more air support to carry him back from where the other hole's exit would have put him, and he had to stop Godzilla in that moment. So he's just a hero. Like
there's
he's
no
just
water support.
A friggin' hero.
I've gotten way off track. All right, yeah.
I do have a question related to what you're talking about, and that's. When we look at a lot of these cinematic universes, one, I think the go-to that we talk about is Marvel, because it's just the most successful one. There is a very consistent kind of look to Marvel movies. There's a very similar structure to a lot of the Marvel movies. And they also connect rather cleanly from one to the next. Like, that's been one of the kind of appeals within them. The thing that stands out to me, again, about the development of the MonsterVerse franchise is that a lot of this gobbledygook started popping up in, I mean, Kong Skull Island, but really Godzilla King of Monsters, just a ton of it, just very, very, we're throwing everything out the window, just kick back and have fun. And then it ends in that same point where, like, it's just silly. Like, there is not, I do not think the people who really responded well to the first Godzilla would respond well to where the franchise ended up. So is it like, so what's the through line? Like, is it just the fact that we have an attachment to these characters? Is it just that we want to see the monsters smash and fight and we're just going to go with it, like you said, because it's available on streaming and we don't have to pay the money? Like, Libby, what is it that made this thing last for four movies? My answer is just IP, but I don't know.
I think, well, yeah.
Forcing the IP down our throats.
Yeah. So I was a big fan of Godzilla 2014. I have heard it has not aged that well, largely because there aren't actually human characters to glom onto. But the fights in that, the spectacle of that was so memorable that that's all I left. And you have to understand, I had seen Peter Jackson's Kong, and I think I'd seen the original Kong. And I'd seen pieces of the like 70s Kong. Big monkey gonna die. Everyone cry.
That's very sad.
Right. I wasn't super into it. So this was my first Godzilla, and I remember sitting down and watching. And when Godzilla lit up, I freaked the fuck out. I thought it was the best thing. No one told me Godzilla lit up. I love things that light up, honestly. And it was just amazing. I left that theater on such a high. It was very exciting.
Hold on. Not to jump the gun, but is the argument you're making in the moment that scene, the power of that scene of seeing Godzilla light up and the execution and the build up to it carried us through three more movies? Like, that was enough to get you to Godzilla versus Kong?
Honestly, yes.
Great. I support it.
Yes,
I agree with you that setup was immaculate. I also
don't disagree with Libby when you consider the fact that the King of Monsters poster is Godzilla shooting the light into the sky from his body, and the biggest moment from the trailer of Godzilla versus Kong was Kong coming at Godzilla with the axe and Godzilla breathing the fire. Like, that, his laser fire might be enough to have carried this through four movies.
There's just nothing.
That's the only connective tissue you need. The gobbledygook surrounding it, you can forget. But if he does the fire breath, you're good.
Yeah. Well, like, what? It's that universal language of cinema. What else do we have that provides that? You can watch a Star Wars and, you know, it can split a ship in half and there are lightsabers and shit. But, like, a giant monster shooting flame, nuclear flames from its mouth, and it's blue, which is every child's favorite, like, you know, you want the blue sucker, you want the blue popsicle, you want that, like, there's just something innately, I love this, I want this, this is very exciting. And then you loop in Kong, and Kong himself brings the human aspect to this, because he is an ape, because he is so human without all of the terrible things about humans. Yeah, I mean, he's very innocent, but when provoked, he will tear a dinosaur's head off and drink its brains. Like, I mean, who among us has not been in that place? I think the combination of the two is giving people something, is giving people, is scratching a certain cinematic itch. You know, we've always, like, humanity has always been obsessed with huge monsters. Like, that has always been, there's always been a lore, there's always been the Leviathan and these things that we can't explain. I think it's just something we inherently love. So if it's done pretty well, our bar's pretty low, and it's definitely entertaining enough to get a little wasted, get a little high, throw it on streaming in the middle of a low-key weekend, and have a relatively good time. And this scratched all of those itches for me.
Yeah,
I think it's enough to sustain a series. There's a cinematic universe where people drive fast cars, and like, I don't. Like, that is very successful.
They do more than drive the cars fast. They do all sorts of crazy things with the cars.
Yeah. They also drive them furiously. I understand.
I will say, Libby, you hit on something that I never really thought about, is the fact that, like, even in a Star Wars, that is mapping onto things that exist in our world. It's a dogfight. It's an atomic bomb, like blowing up the Death Star. You know, these are things that like exist in our world, just like transposed into outer space. I guess you could make an argument that like Godzilla versus Kong is, you know, the battles of nature on a scale, on a magnitude, you know, 10 times, 100 times what they actually are. But they still feel otherworldly and aren't. There's not a direct correlation to something that exists in our natural world. It's not planet Earth tuned up to 11. It's like, this is wholly different.
And it's not even like Planet of the Apes, where it's like just like humanity but apes.
Yeah.
So obviously better than humanity. But
I also think you make a good point, just in the sense that one of the things that connects a lot of these cinematic universes is the spectacle more than necessarily the story. Like in TV, what we've, you know, become invested in and typically, you know, keeps us coming back week to week are the characters and what's happening to those characters, you know, over the course of years, really. But if you're going to be building a cinematic universe in which you only visit them for 2 hours every 2 to 3 years, or, you know, when Marvel amps it up, you're visiting some of them or parts of it, you know, one at a time over the course of a certain amount of time, you have to have something to come back to that's not necessarily just waiting for the next beat of the story. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the character. Like, it does make a certain degree of sense that we would come back to Kong versus Godzilla to relive just the incredible spectacle that we saw in the first film, to be like, this is the basis of a lot of studio sequels. Like, the first one was great. You want to have that emotion again. And when you're dealing with... when you're dealing with subjects that are just big, giant, destructive creatures who fight things, then you're just going to have to keep delivering the satisfying spectacle of watching those big, giant creatures fight. And, you know, I think that I would have preferred a different outcome for sure in Kong versus Godzilla. I also would have preferred a different style to presenting these warring creatures. But was I still happy to watch them fight? Absolutely. Adam Wingard, the director, did a good job, and it's much different than what Gareth Edwards did. It's a much different kind of movie, but he's still smart enough and savvy enough to capitalize on the spectacle of it all, and yeah, that's probably enough.
Is this the time when you cry about Kong?
Again, I think we should phrase it more as the time that Libby gloats about Godzilla, but yeah, big spoiler warning for anyone who doesn't know the ending and wants to preserve the suspense. I think Kong got absolutely destroyed in this movie. I do not think he won a single bit of it. There's that awkward line that Leo and I talked about before the pod, where somebody, I think it was Alexander Skarsgård, says, well, looks like Kong won round two. And it was like he had to say that so that you knew Kong got a win, because it looked like it was very much a tie at that point.
Otherwise, it's a TKO. He was knocked, right, otherwise it's just knocked down like, three times. He's out. It's over.
I guess it's just, you know, whatever. But by the end, it was very clear that Godzilla won the fight. And I will give them credit for choosing a victor, giving us a decisive victor, rather than punting down the line as I expected them to do, where it's like, once, you know, Godzilla won the first fight, they'd let Kong win the second fight, and then they'd come together to fight the Mecha Godzilla. That seemed like the obvious story beat. For them to give us a winner, I respect. For the decisions they made leading up to that winner, I have lots of questions.
Guys, what did you expect? Like, it's a walking nuclear reactor. Like, what did you expect exactly?
I think what I needed as a Kong stan was a little more logic from Kong. And he didn't really bring that until the second battle, it felt like. And obviously the first one, he's sedated. It's mostly on water. It's not his fault, I don't think. That's an unfair fight. That's not a good place for Kong to be. Godzilla is amphibious. He can be in the water and on land. He's very good in both arenas. It's the old bear v.
Huge
shark.
Huge home field advantage.
It's the old bear v. shark Huge. Scenario that I mentioned in our Slack channel. It's like Kong in too much water, Kong is useless, just like a bear would be in open sea against a shark. And I think that's what happened there. I think on land, using a weapon, you know, Kong is better. That was when I was watching Kong Skull Island, I wrote to you guys, like, here's the advantage. He can use tools. He has, you know, thumbs, he uses tools, he can do these things. And I think
I did get nervous when Godzilla started pushing Kong toward the water during the fight. He got him toward the bay, and I was like, oh, no, get away from there, Kong. Yeah, that's not where you want to be right now. But yeah, and also that's I think a mistake from Kong, as well as, you know, to take ourselves outside of the story, the directors and the conceptual artists, if you're going to tear down a city, if you're going to, you know, destroy Hong Kong, let Kong pick up some shit in the city and use it in the fight. Like, don't just let buildings crumble around him. You know, like, rip a chunk out of a notable bridge, grab a sign off of a building and shove it into Godzilla's mouth. Like, let's have a little more fun with the surroundings, which didn't really happen. Anyway,
he did a little bit. Like, he had picked up a crane to use as a weapon at one point. I thought that was very
clever. He used a top of a building as, like, a shield for a hot second. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted more specifics, but
I will say, and granted, Kong hasn't had anyone sort of challenge him in a long, long time, aside from the Skull Crusher from the first Kong Skull Island movie.
Which
he's not training.
Ago,
he's not
like,
training all the time.
40,
it's Rocky One, you guys. Like he's. I mean, the victory is in showing up and holding his own. He was in it through the end, and I know that's not satisfying for you, but you have to understand, like, it was shocking he made it out of the first 42 minutes, to be completely honest. So, like, this is all...
I love that's a moral victory. A moral victory for Kong.
I can't believe that instead of gloating, I am sitting here trying to console you two losers and your big stupid monkey.
He's not stupid.
I know. I think that's what I wanted.
Was not smart.
I wanted a little more tactical thinking on Kong's part. But I think what I'm saying is he didn't have a lot of practice. Yeah. Godzilla in the last movie had to fight all the monsters.
Yeah.
Godzilla had to fight all the monsters. Yeah. And
who won?
Monster Zero, and beat Monster Zero. Like, Godzilla has had practice recently. That last Kong battle was 1973.
Let's also not forget that Godzilla was given, like, a crazy amount of nuclear energy at the end of the last movie, so you could argue that he was roided up, which is an unfair advantage against Kong as well.
I mean, you're telling me that you're telling me that Kong didn't gain any energy from
the defibrillator
bouncing around Hollow Earth?
I don't think so. That's like taking a long-distance flight. That's like flying from, you know, from England to Los Angeles and then,
like,
getting into a fight. You're going to be a little bit, you know.
I thought you were talking about the
hungover,
like the atomic defibrillator thing to bring him back from the cusp of death.
No, 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 that's like after you have one heart attack, you're more susceptible to your second heart attack. I don't think that helped him at all. But
can we talk about the team up toward the end where they work together to solve a problem?
Which is all anyone really wanted.
That sucked.
I think that's the lesson for anyone watching. You got to work together to solve problems.
Listen, I want to talk about how Godzilla didn't kill your boy. Like,
could have. It didn't.
Could have. He didn't.
Definitely could have. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Again, like you walked away.
This brings us back to
his respect.
Well, good thing he didn't, because he would have died otherwise.
Yeah, I mean that's
back.
We all would have died.
It's supposed to be the balancing act here, but I guess if there was one theme that you could take away from this from the franchise overall, it would be balance. Like it would be like there's a need for balance on the planet, I guess, not necessarily the universe, but that in and of itself is such a stretch. And I think that it is a mistake in this movie and a mistake overall to kind of keep manipulating Godzilla into whatever he needs to be in the moment. Like it felt like they started off on such sound footing in the original picture where it's like, listen, you know, we did this to ourselves. Now he's got to intervene and save us from our own, you know, fuck ups. And kind of coming to the realization of Godzilla as a hero figure in that original movie seemed like such a journey for us to make and such a journey for the characters, you know, as thin as they were, to go on and to find kind of, you know, a respect for nature and for Earth and for, you know, the balance of things again. That felt like it just kind of drifted out the window, especially by this movie, where all of a sudden, as soon as Godzilla resurfaces at the beginning, Kyle Chandler, our hero from the third film, suddenly just reverts and is like, "Whoa, Godzilla's here, and he's tearing stuff up. He's evil now. Let's try to figure out a way to kill him." After the whole the two Godzilla movies have been about completely changing people's minds about what Godzilla is and why he's here. And then again, they just ask them to revert back to a mentality that isn't justified. And it's again, the kind of logic that you expect from dumb, stupid, but fun entertainment. And you just have to go with it. But it is frustrating, at least for me. And as if you were someone who was attached to Godzilla as a character, for them to manipulate them like that, to just kind of make it more acceptable to see jets shoot missiles at Godzilla again. Like, yeah. Why do they keep doing that? It has no effect on him. I don't understand. They do it in every movie, and it's just like, this doesn't hurt.
Although, sorry. I was very, to circle back a little bit, it was great when Kong would grab a plane and whip it at Godzilla. that was amazing. It was great when Kong crushed that spaceship in his hand and was just like without even think, he was just like, I don't want
looked
this
at it.
This is
bye.
And then like wiped his like, did the it was like the after like the that's just gross, I have something gross on my hand. That was great, but yeah, it is very frustrating that they are trying to force these two characters into very like tired human tropes. Like why did I watch any of the first if it's just gonna be like, well, Godzilla's bad and Kong is good, and the way you know Kong is good is because he fucking knows sign language now, right? And has red blood.
They should have allowed Godzilla to be able to communicate telepathically with Millie Bobby Brown. I think that would have put him on even playing field.
I think so too. I just think that there is a natural, I don't know. I think they just lost whatever thread they kind of had at the beginning of this cinematic universe. Like Godzilla was came to be a sort of a grand balance, rectifying the balance of the Earth to like save the Earth, as we talked about, and. I don't know, dragging Kong into it was always going to be dicey. You couldn't just have it be a supremacy thing because there's no investment in that. So then trying to rehash everything as, you know, bad versus good was weird. They really honestly should have just, and what they were trying to do was like, man is really the evil. They should have just leaned back into that. Like, because clearly that was the subtext of everything. It was men manipulating Kong to get him off the island, to get him to Hollow Earth. It was man...
man manipulating Kong to just keep him in the bubble. Yeah. Like, when they put him in a bubble instead of letting him roam across the island beginning. Like you're saying, all the pieces were there for it to be, these two titans need to be left alone and do their own thing, and you need to respect that, as opposed to try to control everything like people do.
But at some point, we should talk about how this was cast almost entirely with TV All-Stars. And to go back to a very distant point, I think that's exactly why, you know, this universe couldn't work as a week-to-week series, obviously, because the characters are not very fleshed out. We don't actually need to see them week to week because they're doing the one thing over and over again, although it seems to work for CBS. But with the MCU, that is what we're seeing too. Like, do we need to, are these characters deep enough? Are they well-rounded enough? Do we have the ability to get them to the place where they're well-rounded enough where we need to be seeing them week to week? And I don't know. I love seeing Falcon and Bucky. I love seeing Sam and Bucky argue over what a witch or a wizard or an alien is. But I don't know how to rectify that with all of the also hyper serious things they're trying to fold into that, into Falcon and Winter Soldier as well.
I mean, as we've discussed a bunch on the podcast, I think it will be interesting to see how the MCU continues to develop its television projects specifically, because it does feel like the early ones are very clear versions of the movies that have just been broken up into parts and kind of put a TV aesthetic on top of it. But what I also think is interesting about the Godzilla versus Kong development and the manipulation of Godzilla into whatever you need him to be, it does kind of mimic the pushback that we see in certain TV shows that go on long enough, where then they make their characters make certain decisions that the fans reject. That the fans are like, no, 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 I've come to know this person long enough. I know they wouldn't do that. I know why you're doing that. I know, you know, what you're trying to get them to do, like to put them in a position to, you know, have a battle or to increase drama or to just continue the series or whatever the, you know, the motivation is. But people usually reject that. Like, people usually, if they do have an attachment to that character, that becomes the tipping point for the series, and they're like, we're out. Like, I can't trust you guys anymore. This is going to be a breaking point. And I think that's what will be interesting in terms of how the MonsterVerse continues. We don't know exactly what's next, but are people going to feel like, okay, I either really liked the original Godzilla and didn't like what it turned into, or I didn't like the original Godzilla and what it turned into is still something different and weird. But is the spectacle, is the memory of Godzilla and Kong going to be strong enough to just push it through, or are they going to have to reboot in some way, or are we going to be dealing with a whole heck of a lot more Hollow Earth for the next 10 to 15 years? That notion that, like, Skull Island was the dumping grounds, or I don't remember the term, for Hollow Earth, like, monster creation, yeah. Like, that's where all of the monsters were from, and then they just kind of had an output on Skull Island, which is why it had so many weird things happening in that movie. Like, that's a perfect setup for,
I mean,
whatever comes next.
That is the only thing that I see sort of on the books. I don't know how locked in it is, but apparently there's a Skull Island animated series that is connected to the MonsterVerse that I guess Netflix bought January of this year. But I don't know when that's going to come out or when it's going to be produced. But that does kind of seem like the next logical jumping off point from this movie to, like, burst some new monsters for them to fight. We need new monsters.
Yeah. Also, in terms of the cast, like you mentioned, Libby, you could make the argument that that first movie made a very declarative statement, and that we are going to focus on TV stars. We're going to lean on TV stars who you've already come to love and have a connection with by starting the movie with Bryan Cranston, known television star, known beloved father figure from Malcolm in the Middle, and slightly less beloved but respected father figure from Breaking Bad, staring at acclaimed film actress Juliette Binoche as she gets murdered in the first, like, 5 minutes. So it's basically saying, bye-bye, movie stars. We're going to trust the TV people to carry us through. And then you've got you know, Kyle Chandler, dad of all dads, trying to build an emotional connection in the third Godzilla.
You got True Bloods, Alexander Skarsgård, Stranger Things, Millie Bobby Brown.
Emmy winning Alexander Skarsgård. Big Little Lies, Emmy winning.
Atlanta's Brian Tyree Henry. You get, of course, early editions, Kyle Chandler.
Right, very good. Because you can at least do John Goodman from Roseanne in Kong Skull Island.
Eugene Cordero from The Good Place. Pillboy shows up in Kong Skull Island.
Oh. Golden Globe winner Tom Hiddleston for The Night Manager. So yeah, we've got some TV there.
I'm sorry, United States of Terra's Brie Larson.
Right, great point.
The Good Place is Mark Evan Jackson.
Who was just rudely murdered in that
movie. I think that might be my favorite thing of all these movies is how indiscriminately characters are killed off.
Oh yeah,
like.
And just never mentioned
which
again.
I think is sort of, I see all the points, not to get back to the first question Ben asked me, I see all the points people make about Godzilla 2014, that it's not about the humans, that the humans are boring, that the humans are whatever. But in some ways, that movie, the way it actually does treat its human characters, you have these sort of three main characters that stay alive throughout the whole entire thing and are sort of always at the right place at the right time to catch Godzilla doing whatever he has to do. Like, the Aaron Taylor Johnson character is essentially everywhere Godzilla is at every point in Godzilla's journey. Where I'd rather just have that be random people getting murdered and slaughtered. Because the thing that movie does best is have the scope to, like, Cloverfield it up and have it be like, I'm staring at a massive trunk of a leg. And Godzilla's head is 400 feet above me. Like, it is so high above me. As opposed to, I think, a lot of these last three movies, which feature action shot as if they were humans. And the buildings are, you know, going back to, like, the old Toho versions of Godzilla. But, like, don't give you that same sense of scope and scale like that first Godzilla does.
God, that's such a good point, Leo. I hadn't really thought of that, even though while I was watching last night, there were many times where I was like, how big is... I don't understand how big... Like, they seem to keep fluctuating in sizes, specifically Kong. As much as I stupid loved watching this movie, which I think is how I have to care, because I... It's not a good movie. Let's just be honest. They lost the scope. The scope was all over the place. Kong seemed pretty tiny. When he was in Hollow Earth, he seemed, you know, normal, like, appropriately sized when he was fighting Godzilla, but also the buildings didn't seem tall enough. Like, that's such a good point. And I haven't seen Godzilla. I didn't actually revisit any of the films in the lead up to this. So I haven't seen that in a while. And but now that you mention it, that is very clear to me. And honestly, I think one of the most frightening things about the Godzilla movies, and something that even the Toho films used to see a lot, because you would always see the people like, looking up in fear, and we don't
there was like
really have
there was
that
like one
anymore.
Or two shots in the big fight in Hong Kong where like I'm like, oh, that's kind of an homage, where it's like people running into the subway and like you kind of see stuff happening above them, but like it's not enough to sort of like, I almost feel like you want to see a lot of the fight from that vantage and like see these buildings coming down and like see it scaled that way. I agree with you. Kong's scale was all over the place. The fact that both Kong and Godzilla could fit on a battleship, I was like,
I don't,
no, that does not work.
I did like that Kong jumped from the battleship that he was on to another battleship. Like, he hopscotched battleships to get to the bigger one, because he was like, no, this one's not going to be enough for me. I need a little more leeway over here.
Also, my friends are on this ship.
I completely agree that they did. Also, my buddies are here.
That's
a great point. I think that this, you know, to kind of bring it home, I guess, a little bit, that first Godzilla and the perspectives that it uses, I agree that it is somewhat unbelievable in terms of, like, these three characters, Ken Watanabe, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and I don't know who the third one is.
I mean, Elizabeth Olsen. But also, I say Elizabeth Olsen and their kid. Like, their kid happens to be on the Golden Gate Bridge in the middle of the bridge.
Yeah, that's the...
And I'm like, well, you gotta be fucking shitting me.
But see, this was the thing where I guess it just kind of splits, because I don't have a problem with that, because I recognize the need to have the perspectives grounded in people who aren't random, and that they need to be grounded in people who are going to take a more active role in whatever's going on there. So I thought it was a very smart move for them to make Aaron Taylor-Johnson kind of following the military throughout everything that he's doing, because one, he's part of the military, but two, the military is going to stick by wherever Godzilla is going. Like, they kind of allowed that to happen for me so that I could believe it. And then, as I mentioned in our long threads of spoiler reactions to all of these movies, I do think that the Godzilla movies owes a debt to how they shot Cloverfield, but it also suffered from that very same kind of reverence that it showed, because I think the scale and the impact and everything that you admire about watching Godzilla in that movie comes from you relating to the perspectives in which he's framed, and relating to kind of the powerlessness that you feel when you're put in that scenario, as opposed to being kind of the godlike person, you know, just hovering over the action scenes. But the complaints that were levied against Cloverfield were mainly bottled up in the idea that we didn't see enough of the monster. And I don't think it was ever really a question of not seeing enough of a monster that bothered people. I think it's that that they wanted to have a clear picture of something that they didn't actually really want. It's the Jaws conundrum. It's the Alien conundrum. It's the you really only need to be shown enough to understand what's happening and to understand the consequences, and then feel the scale and feel the impression of what's happening. And I feel like that's what worked with Godzilla. Like, they bottled it all up for that one or two moments in the end where you did get to appreciate what Godzilla had done and kind of be awestruck by it, as opposed to these movies where they're like, no, we're just going to give the people what they think they want, and we're going to show them everything. We're going to see... We're going to have Kong modeled after John McClane, which is a very real thing that the director said that he did in like multiple instances, where the way that Kong moves and acts in the action scenes and does the fight, the jump is one of them. The shoulder pop where he has to reset his shoulder. Like, that's another one. And I noted a third one, but I already forgot what it was.
Are you walking on glass at any point?
yeah, probably. I mean, you can make the argument.
All over Kong.
But that's the thing that people think they want to see with these, and they're going to give it to them. It's why Kong goes back and forth between acting like an ape and acting like a human. They want you to have a very blatant image of Kong as being a human surrogate. And I don't think that's what actually people want. I think it's just easier to give that to them than to try to fight for the other position, which is a lot more effective and would have been more sustainable for this kind of universe. But, you know, here we are.
You're right about... There is something... I'd like to talk to a motion graphics person about this. There is something to the fact that, like, in the first Godzilla film and in the second Godzilla film, King of Monsters, everything is either shot so it's, like, from a person's vantage and you're looking up at this giant thing that you can't really get a whole sense of in one frame, or it's clouded in mist or fire or snow. Like, King of Monsters, there's some, the first fight with, like, Monster Zero, you can barely see what the hell is happening. Like, it's like there's so much digital snow in front of the camera, and it's like they're obscuring Godzilla, I think potentially because Godzilla in the light of day is kind of silly looking, whereas Kong is just like a bigger version of a gorilla, and Godzilla, for whatever reason, just kind of looks silly. He's not quite a dinosaur, he's not quite a lizard, he's this weird thing, and so they obscure him a bunch, in all the movies.
That's
until
why
maybe
I like
you get
him
to hear.
So much. That's why I like him so much, because he's such a weird chonky boy with such a tiny head, and that's why when the main villain, not man, arrives in Godzilla vs. Kong, I'm just like, I don't like you. You're very bony and not chonky, and it's just not working for me. You're a bad guy.
Millions of Screens is a production of the Penske Media Corporation. IndieWire, our theme music features excerpts of the classic YouTube video, Bjork Talking About TV, and Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory. Our editor-in-chief is Dana Harris-Brights, and our publisher is James Israel, and our executive editor is Anne Donahue. Our favorite cinematic universes actually exist on TV, and they are the New Girl / Brooklyn Nine-Nine cinematic universe, the Jason Katham cinematic universe, and the Carrie Coon cinematic universe. IndieWire's Millions of Screens endorses TV! We love TV. We promise we'll get back to TV next week, though, as the poll stated, the majority of people are going to watch Godzilla vs. Kong on TV, on HBO Max.
Or their phone, or their computer, or...
Oh, no, man, I meant to go on a big, long Veronica Mars movie rant in the middle of that podcast, but I completely forgot about it.
To be fair, whenever we talk about HBO, we're not really talking about TV.
Okay, that's enough. Wrap it up.
You can find us on Twitter at Million Screens, at Midwest Spitfire, Ben T. Travers, and at Leo Adrian Garcia. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play. So leave a review and let us know what you think. This is Ben, Libby, and Leo reminding you as always that you shouldn't let poets lie to you.
You shouldn't let poets lie to you.
Ain't nothing wrong with a couple of cold brews and a cool podcast.